You're listening to Time Lost, a poetry podcast by Perdu, Center for Poetry and Experimentation in Amsterdam. We invite authors to undust a work that has gone unpublished or was unpublishable in the first place. Every episode, you'll be hearing a work that is now being granted a second chance.
Welcome to Time Lost. My name is Romy de Winkel, and today's guest is UK-based poet Emily Berry. Welcome, Emily. Very happy to have you here.
Thank you.
So the format of this podcast is that we ask authors to bring an unpublished or unpublishable work. And the text you brought, Emily, for today does not have a title yet, maybe. And we will now listen to your reading of this work.
Thank you very much. I'll just say that ahead of reading the work that, it doesn't have a title, I guess, because I was very intrigued by the topic, unpublishable. And for me, as soon as I start thinking about titling something, then that's getting into the realm of thinking about publishing it, I guess. And I had quite a hard time choosing something that for me fitted the category. So what I've selected in the end are a series of transcripts from dreams, because I use dreams quite a lot in my work. And these are ones which, for whatever reason, have not been ever used in any way. So that's why there's no title, but we could just say that they're dream transcripts. I'm looking after my goddaughter and offer to read her a bedtime story. We're in my flat and I've tucked her up in my bed. The book she has selected is Ghosts of My Life by Mark Fisher. I'm about to start reading it, but then think better of it, saying, maybe I should read you something else. Prior to this, I'd noticed someone sobbing in the room next door, a grown woman. My goddaughter says it's H. I say, maybe I should go check on her. When I do, the woman is about to leave. It's not H, but she's vaguely familiar. I follow her and ask if she's okay. I say, I'm here to talk anytime she likes. She's cynical about this and doesn't believe me, which makes me wonder if I believe it myself. There's a group of children, siblings, living in a rundown tenement building. They've recently moved in and want to make it clear to the other street kids living there that they're not to be messed with. They beat up another child really badly and leave him there to be found. Two of the younger ones hide in some toilets nearby and appear very frightened and vulnerable, so that when they're discovered, no one will connect them with what happened. Everyone in the building is an orphan. I'm in front of this big Gothic house where I'm living but don't feel welcome. I see three owls sitting on a fence. They're very beautiful, and I call P to come and look at them. It seems I live with the owls. Inside the house, the mother owl, who turns out to be very sinister, explains that they made the house very homely and cozy for me in order for it to ultimately be a scarier, bleaker place to live. Elle and I go to visit C, who has just had a baby. There's no sign of the baby at first until she asks if we would like to see it, and then brings downstairs a raw egg. The yolk is particularly pronounced. I'm observing a little boy in some kind of rural setting in the olden days. He's looking across a big field towards some transportation which will take him to school. An omnibus or maybe a horse-drawn carriage. And he drops his teddy, which has been hanging from his hand. He doesn't notice and goes on his way to school. I imagine his distress when he gets there and realizes his loss. The teddy, maybe a rabbit, is lying in a muddy rut in the ground and a huge tractor is coming towards it. At the last minute, the tractor swerves to avoid the teddy, and it's such a relief. I was trying to catch hold of this beautiful, tiny black fish that swam vertically, like a seahorse. Thought it was maybe a tadpole that would turn into a frog. I'm with a large assembled group, and a messenger comes in, carrying something covered with a cloth. He removes the cloth and reveals a parrot. The parrot flies off and perches somewhere, then delivers the news that Tom Cruise is dead. In a session, my therapist announces that I'm finished with my therapy and ready to end. I protest that I'm not ready at all. I still need lots more help, but she's insistent and even radiant with the news. I get to the point where I'm begging, saying no, she's made a mistake, but she assures me that she's right and that this will be our last session. I'm in the flat with P and we hear a knock at the door. When I open it quite soon afterwards, there's no one there. The stairwell is empty. There's something eerie about it. I shut the door quickly, but something doesn't seem right, as if someone has got inside. I comment on this to P, worrying that someone could get in. He says I could put the chain on the door. When I go to do this, I see the chain has broken and is lying on the ground. We realize something else is wrong. The blind that covers the door is no longer there, and all the bright light from the hall is coming in. We check outside again and find the blind is now on the outside of the door, rolled up, and my coat is there too, caught in the blind and bunched up at the top. P and I have been assigned animals to look after. P has 3 owls to care for, 2 small and 1 big. A van has turned up to collect the animals, and I see a small crowd of people has gathered round the van. Apparently, they want to get a look at P's owls. I notice the larger owl seems to be looking over at me. It gets out of the van and heads in my direction. It's about the size of a 5-year-old. The owl seems keen to meet me. It waddles towards me and holds out one wing slightly as if to shake hands. There's a mutual respect between us because we both love P. We touch hand and wing a few times, and then he returns to the van.
Thank you, Emily, for this wonderful reading. I love the touching hand and wing. That's really cute. So, like you already said, you told me that it's a compilation of dreams. Could you tell me a little bit about the curation process of this text? So how did you decide which dreams to include and which ones to not include?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting in relation to the topic, because so when you first asked me to take part in the podcast and that the sort of theme was unpublishable, I was thinking, what am I going to do for this? Because the things that I consider unpublishable that I have in my sort of like poems that I've written with the aim of actually doing something are usually ones that I just think have no redeeming features and so wouldn't want to share them. And then I was thinking, what else? And then so then I hit upon, because I do write down my dreams when I can and often use them in my work. So I thought I would look through my notebooks and see if I had any that I hadn't used. But even that process sort of involved a process of trying to make them more publishable in air quotes, in the sense that I thought, well, I'm going to be reading them in public, as it were. And I guess I chose to read ones which I thought would have some degree of interest to a listener, whether through just the kind of scenario being striking in some way or funny, or maybe they're ones which I kind of felt like I might have done something with, but for whatever reason, that just didn't happen. Like they didn't feel translatable enough, or that I guess I was personally attached to them in some way. So I guess these came over probably the last couple of years. And I just sort of went through my notebooks and picked out ones that struck me. And then I ended up having to type them up in order to make them, send them to you and so on. So even that process then started getting into the realm of thinking about publishableness. And I sort of made a few sort of small edits, or like I've changed people's names to initials and things to sort of slightly make them feel less personal, I guess.
Yeah, I was curious about that also, because all the characters in these texts are like H, B, L, C. And the fact that their names are not fully written out adds a sense of privacy to it. Mm. I was curious if this was important to you when compiling this text because of maybe ideas about publishability or privacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always interesting when you dream about someone. Obviously, we all dream about people who are in our lives. And it's kind of, I guess, common to dream a lot about your partners and friends and so on. But there's people who may be more peripheral that if you tell, it's always a thing of like, if you tell someone that you've dreamt about them, how will they interpret that? And actually, I don't think any of the people mentioned in these, all the initials here are like close people who are close to me, so they wouldn't be alarmed to find I'm dreaming about them. But I have had quite a lot of dreams about people I don't really know, like literary figures I'm connected with online or whatever. And I did consider an alternative group of dreams, which would have been dreams featuring random literary people that I know on social media and not disguising their names. But yeah, I didn't feel that that would quite be, I would feel too awkward about that, because that those people, if they ever listen to it, might think, why is she dreaming about me?
Yeah. It has very big implications. And I guess Tom Cruise is like far enough to not feel paranoid about it.
Yeah. Did you think he listens to the podcast?
Well, we don't know. Maybe we should figure that out. Yeah, so in your second book, Stranger Baby, there's a poem titled Girl on a Liner, in which you also seem to work a lot with dreams and the description of a dream. Mm. And there you start out the poem with the sentence, "This is the body's way of handling emotion." And I was wondering if this is indeed what's at stake for you in dream sharing.
Yeah, that's a good thing to pick up on, I think. I don't actually remember if that poem was one that kind of drew on dreams or not, but I think that's it, that the, you know, there's all this cliche of like, oh, people find it boring hearing people talk about their dreams. And, well, I'm sure that's true. And maybe, you know, these dreams are boring. I don't know. But for me, it's more like it's in the telling of the dream as to whether it's boring or not. And actually, as a writer, if you're working with material from the subconscious, which a lot of us are, the dream is like really a kind of gift in bringing you something that you might not get in another way. Because for me, writing is always a sort of process of like a translation or transformation of a feeling into something that can be read, and that feeling can be transmitted to a different person. And in the dream, that process has kind of already happened, and you might not even know what is underneath the story of the dream, but it's kind of given you images or details that can sort of help in the process of putting together a poem or another piece of writing, maybe.
Yeah, as you already said, it's like also writing them down sort of forces you as a writer to push them in a bit of a narrative mold.
Yeah.
I guess this is also maybe for some people what disinterests them in this process, because it's very plot heavy. And I guess a lot of contemporary writing sort of has discarded that.
Mm.
But at the same time, I think there's a lot of humor also precisely in this plot that you have selected now, like the baby that turned out to be a raw egg or something. It's like this reveal,
yeah,
that's almost a bit uncommon now, but works really well, I think.
Mm. Well, I think, I mean, obviously dreams are by their nature quite surreal. And so, and that's something which I really value in writing. I mean, I don't even really like the term surreal, because it sort of seems to take it into some sort of area of like oddity, when in fact it's completely normal in some ways. Like everything is mixed up in life and bizarre in various different ways, but in dreams that can just happen more literally. So yeah, I think that's like the way that in a dream, like that one with the raw egg, you don't question, or you often don't question the sort of weirdness of it. It's just like, oh, here's my baby and it's a raw egg. And you're like, oh, hi, you know, there he or she is. I don't know what I find so great about that, but I do. And I like poetry that does that in the same way, like that takes a sort of apparently surreal setting, but makes it just seem completely normal. Because I think somehow it does add a humor to it, but I don't know, it brings out other things around it somehow.
But I think I have approached it almost as more as a method also when reading it for the first time and when hearing you read it again now, I really pick it up as a method.
Mm. Yeah, and I was just thinking it's kind of a way of making you see all like familiar things afresh each time, like writing and or being any kind of artist. I think it requires like an attention to things that is able to draw out new things all the time, even from very familiar settings. Like I love the poet C.A. Conrad has these writing rituals that he calls thematic poetry rituals, which are exactly that. They encourage the person doing the ritual to sort of find sort of newness and strangeness in like very everyday situations. Like he has one, which I've always meant to do. I never have actually done it yet, where I think it's on his website, where he suggests you kind of look at like very ordinary objects in your house in different ways. Like look at the fridge through an upside down glass, like, or through a telescope or something, or then open up the fridge and start kind of smelling the things in it and like peering at them and stuff. And I think maybe that's what dreams help with a bit, in that they do that for you. And also in that they just like create kind of ready-made images sometimes that can convey emotion. Like when you were talking about narrative, I agree that like people don't use narrative so readily in poetry and maybe can be a bit suspicious of it. But I think sometimes the narrative can convey an emotion sort of in a sort of subtle way that you wouldn't necessarily. I often think of a comment that Sophie Collins made in an interview. I can't remember where the interview was, but talking about the use of images. And I think she said something like, if you describe like a dirty mattress with a stain on it in an empty room, you get a much stronger sense of a feeling of shame from that, maybe, than just saying, I felt ashamed. And because dreams are all about kind of atmosphere a lot of the time, I think there's something similar happening there.
I can see that. And it's also very, now that I think of it, the dreams you've selected are also quite object heavy in that sense, or like descriptive of visual in that sense.
Yeah. Those objects then become symbols that you can sort of work with.
I can imagine when you hear this as a listener, it has strong connotations with like Freudian dream interpretation and all its complications.
Mm.
I am also, especially since you write quite a lot about therapy in other works, and there's also a therapist in this one.
Yeah.
I am curious if you could speak a little bit to how you approach this implicit theoretical and historical connection.
So there's various strands to that. I mean, firstly, I would say this is a kind of, I don't always talk so much about the involvement of dreams in my writing. I think, like, I wouldn't begin a standard poetry reading by saying, oh, these poems come from dreams, because I think people tend to find that very disappointing. I mean, I don't necessarily think that they should, but I don't want to. It's like, you know, that thing of like reading a short story and then at the end it says, but it was all a dream. And you're like, oh. And that's also what these transcripts are, like raw material. They're not, that's why I consider them unpublishable. They're not like poems. Yeah, in terms of the theory, I mean, my last book was very influenced by thinking about Freud and psychoanalysis in general. It has an epigraph.
This is a Stranger Baby, right?
Yeah. It has an epigraph from one of Freud's letters. And that sort of came about by accident, really, because while I was in the early stages of writing it, I was commissioned to write some poems responding to Freud. And I ended up writing these collages that were taken from letters that Freud had written. So I ended up reading a lot of Freud's letters. And I've actually read far more of his letters than of his actual kind of theoretical writings. But I suppose I've always thought a lot about therapy or that somehow come into my writing quite a bit, because like I was saying earlier about the subconscious, in therapy, you're also exploring the subconscious, or at least in psychoanalytical psychotherapy. And so the two things end up kind of getting intertwined in my experience. And there's maybe a way in which, if you're talking to a therapist, they become a sort of interlocutor in the way that often as a writer, you're writing to maybe not, you know, sometimes obviously you're addressing a specific person, but there might be a you that's sort of more general. In terms of like thinking about the theory of it, I mean, Stranger Baby was sort of written as part of a creative critical PhD, in which at the same time I was writing a thesis, is the word, a critical thesis looking at contemporary elegy, or at least trying to redefine elegy or talk about whether these works were in fact elegiac and if what I was doing was elegiac. And so I read quite a lot of psychoanalytical and just psychological texts about grief. And a lot of what I read ended up getting into the poems, some of it as literally verbatim, sort of collaging material in, and maybe underpinning it in some way. But I don't know that I sort of thought about it I don't know that I could really talk about how it relates to poetry exactly to think about these things, but that it's all part of sort of interacting with your subconscious and how that might play out in poetry.
Yeah. So like both as a personal engagement in terms of therapy, but also as this rolling out of this prompt to write about Freud or in response to Freud. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's somehow there's also an unease in reading too much into your dreams or the ones you shared, not only because I don't want to be like an armchair psychologist or something, but also because it feels very private and there's a sense of privacy that I, as a listener or reader, feel like I shouldn't break or something. So then instead I just experience it and visualize it a lot because of all the objects.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's maybe an unavoidable impulse. Like if someone reads something and they say it's from a dream, you're going to want to analyze it. But I mean, I wouldn't have objected if you wanted to do that. But because also I think like ultimately if someone is analysing your dream and they don't actually really know that much about your life, inevitably they're going to be bringing in their own associations and really they're analysing what the dream would be about if it was their dream, maybe. So, I mean, I'm really interested in dream interpretation and I mean, another reason I write down my dreams is just for my own personal investigation into like why I might be feeling certain ways or I mean, and often I feel like I learn things from dreams about things I'm struggling with that I might not have understood in other ways. But that process it's slightly separate to the process of writing, but not completely. They're intertwined, I would say.
So as a final question, I mean, we've already spoken about it, about our prompt about unpublishability or the unpublishable. Is this something that you find important when working on a text at all? Like, is this something you take as a condition for your writing at all?
It's really hard to say. Because I think I have probably like a lot of writers, because I've certainly spoken with other people about this topic, about this kind of ambivalence around the publishing side of writing, that we all... well, published writers at least, must have a desire to publish things because we continue to do it. But at the same time, it's something that can feel very difficult emotionally or, well, for all kinds of reasons. So I don't think it's not like at the starting point of writing something, I don't think it's like in my mind necessarily that I'm writing for publication. But it's hovering around in the background. I mean, I suppose it, like the longer you have been working as a writer and have, you know, published books, then it's hard to avoid the idea that everything you write has its potential.
I'm really happy that you brought this to this episode because I think it's, again, a very different perspective on our prompt. So we have covered unpublishable because it's too gossipy, so that's more like a sense of privacy. We've also just had people who simply just didn't publish it yet, but were maybe working on it, so it was more like a work in progress kind of thing. So this is, again, a very different angle. So I'm very happy to have had you today as our guest. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm really happy to have been had.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a really nice prompt actually, because when you asked first of all, I thought, oh God, I can't think of anything. Am I going to have to read something I'm really embarrassed by? Mm-hmm. So it was nice to think around the topic and and also just think about that aspect of my process, which I haven't thought about that much.
You've been listening to Time Lost, a podcast by Purdue. You can find more information about the episode and our guest on our website, purdue.nl. This podcast was created with the support of the Amsterdam Fund for the Arts and the Dutch Foundation for Literature. Thanks for listening, and until the next Time Lost.